if I'm hanging around with my players, like let's say I get together for our D&D game next Saturday night, and me and Ray and Andy, who are all going to Gen Con together, and I say, oh, and by the way, I signed up for the dealing with contrarian players seminar. How are they supposed to react?
Well, you don't mean me, right?
Oh, no. And then the next guy at the table.
I'd really like both of you to join me.
I bought you tickets.
Yeah. Welcome to Nerd Burger. It's a podcast with a guy and another guy and a guy on Skype. Happy now?
Very.
I'm Mike.
I'm Craig.
And here we are, episode 62.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And very few hiccups as of late to getting to here. Remember way back in the day, audio issues,
oh,
all
yeah.
That kind of stuff? Okay. That's funny, I guess.
Hiccups.
Yeah.
Mm.
But lately, it's been pretty smooth sailing, so knock on wood and all that. I think we're okay.
Speaking of sailing?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, Jim's here.
In the year of our Lord, 1500.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Nerd Burger.
How's it going?
Things are good.
Hold on.
I like that though.
I know. Well, you own the song.
Why?
It's not like you can't listen to it anytime.
If only there were some vehicle by which I could hear this music when I wanted to. If only I didn't have to wait to go on Nerd Burger every couple of months. Oh, you're right. Okay, we finally have some spring weather up here in Milwaukee, but and I know where you've been, Craig. I know where you've been, and I know this is a much bigger deal for you than it is for me, but can I say something? What? I've been going to Gen Con for over 30 years, okay?
All right.
And I know what's in there. I was there when it was at Parkside, or Platteville, I should say. Parkside, yeah. And I was there when it was in the Mecca for many, many years, right here in the great city of Milwaukee. And I've gone every year that it's been down in Indianapolis.
Okay.
I know what's in the gaming rooms. I know what's in the exhibit hall. What in the name of God persuades all of us to jam in and crash servers the minute that button is available? I wanted one game, guys. One game. That's it. Seriously. I go there to shop, to hang out, have a couple generic tickets, have a good time. And now, because they gave me cool little toy ships, I play Sails of Glory. Okay? It's by the same people who did Wings of Glory, the World War I flying ace game.
Okay.
I now play Sails of Glory, where you go out and you collect the ships. They're exorbitantly expensive, but I have a job now, so I can go out and get my little ships. And they have a couple events at which they give you it's not free because they charge you a lot in tickets.
Right.
I wanted to get into one game.
Mm-hmm.
And I put together my wish list. Now, my wife and I go with my son, and I put together my list, and I set it up, and I knew that you were going to be online, and I waited, and I watched the countdown, and I have a pretty fast internet connection.
I was going to say the exact same thing, and a quick trigger finger button.
I'm saucy. I'm ready, and I want one thing. I want one freaking ticket. That's
right.
It. And I went, bam, you are 3,020 in line.
Yeah.
What?
I was incredibly quick on the draw, and I was 1,600 something in line, 1,700. Andy came in a little over 2,000. Ray swears he hit the button within 1 second. Was in the 4,000s. So in that first second of that button going live, 4,000 plus people clicked the button at the same time.
So that scene on Big Bang Theory where they're trying to get
over
into
and over,
Comic-Con. That happened to you this morning.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's fine. I'll buy the ship separately. I will get it from some poor, unemployed gamer who happened upon my frigate. I'll give you twice for it. Just give me the thing. But it blows my mind that we're just this keyed up on a Sunday to nail down, because there's 50,000 of us that are going to gather down in Indianapolis in a couple of months, and they have tens of thousands of events, but we all have to go through the door first.
Right, but okay, well, first of all, let's punctuate, let's button the story up. Did you get your game?
No! Oh. I did not. And in fairness, I mean, look, I think they did three sessions, which meant there were 36 total tickets.
Right, and those 4,000 people, there might have been 37 people
right,
trying to get that game, and you were number 37.
Right, so yeah, I'm going to go, and I'm going to hang out. It's this impulse that just... It just amazes me, because again, if it isn't free whiskey, crack, and hookers, I don't get it.
in defense of the whole situation, there's a number of things that play into that other than just the, I want to be first in line, right? There are people who Gen Con is like, they live in the boondocks somewhere, and Gen Con's the only time that they get to game. They game once a year, they go to Gen Con, and they want to play the games they like. And so they want to make sure they get those games. Mm-hmm. So you've got people that are like that. You've got people that are going after the rare events that there's only a handful of that a lot of people are going to go after. So sometimes, you know, these 36 seats sold out in a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. And then
can I ask you a question about your first one though?
Sure.
And this is something that always comes after me, and I wonder about this. Let's face it. I mean, once upon a time when I started going to Gen Con all those many years ago, there was a very heavy emphasis. In fact, it came from miniature wargaming, which I think we're going to talk a little bit about in a second. Mm-hmm. It's not anymore. I mean, miniature wargamers back when it was still in Milwaukee got relegated to a ghetto and were told to stay over there and never come out. And now it's a very, very small offering. And we say it's all RPGs. It's predominantly RPGs. And then once upon a time, it was clicks, but those have gone. So now it's just RPG and cards. I mean, that's 90% of the gaming offerings that you see in the book. Right. So my question is, RPG gaming, and I know you do a lot of it, way more than I do, Craig. It has always been to me, I've been in it for 35 years. It's something that's always been very social. Mm-hmm. I've done it with my friends. I've done it with neighbors, and it becomes, and those stories you swap and those things you tell.
Agreed. That's why I do it. It's just as much about just hanging around with my friends as it is about playing the game. Mike, is that fair to say?
For me, it's more about hanging with my friends than it is about playing the games, but okay. Yeah.
and so when you go to a con and you do this, and I've only RPG'd, quite honestly, at a con half a dozen times over the many years. It would seem to me that you lose that social dimension. Now, you might meet somebody that you really like and you get on with it as a friend, but all the internal relationships, it seems to me that it populates the narrative. You get all sorts of in-jokes, characters. You start to share stories. Remember that time 5 years ago when your guy didn't take the stairs but decided to ninja climb the wall outside and so got shot in the face? Things that, well, heck, there's a guy I think you know my son's godfather, Jared, yeah? Mm-hmm. We've talked about him on this show. When we were playing a game called Innomine by Steve Jackson Games once upon a time, he insisted on ninja climbing the outside of a building. And everybody said, Malachi is his character's name, use the stairs. And he said, no, Malachi would climb. I said, but dude, you can use the stairs.
And they're right there. You're standing right there next to them.
Well, they're certainly through that door, which we can all see and is unguarded. Use the stairs. And I'm the dungeon master. And... You know, he decides to climb outside, and without any cheating, and he swore I cheated. I said, no. The guard was always at the window. He had always been. And the guard watched him climb out the outside of the building and shot him in the face.
Right.
So from then on, for years to come, when we played this game, it was, Malachi, use the stairs, dude.
Now,
and so those stories come out, and I wonder... When you go to a con and when you sit down with 6 to 8 strangers, don't you lose a lot of that?
I think it's a different experience when that happens, but you have to keep in mind that it's shifted to Seattle because Wizards of the Coast and like half of the RPG community is out there.
Yep.
The game companies. But there was a time when you started gaming where Wisconsin was mecca for RPGs. Mm-hmm. And so you and I grew up in a world where it was very, very, very easy to get into multiple game groups, to find other people who are gaming. Do you think the guy who lives in Bumblethump, Colorado can do that?
Yeah.
So he got introduced to it in college, played for a while in college, and then went off. Now he's got kids and a family and a job that takes up too much time, and he doesn't get a chance to game because he can't find a group in his wherever he lives, whatever. And then, so he goes to Gen Con once a year to game.
Also, he's now stoned all the time, so yes. He doesn't care.
So he can't stay focused.
I'm not sure how that works in Washington and Seattle, where they're writing
the games.
There's
plenty of people that they go to the convention for the convention experience.
Hey, Mike.
And that's maybe all they've got.
Yes, Jim.
Mike, on your note there, I want to pass out. I don't know. Is there a list of Nerdburger rules, whatever they are? I'd like to add one if there's, and I'll create one if there isn't.
Okay.
Rule one, perhaps.
All right.
Never, ever play HeroClix in a large group with somebody who is incredibly stoned. We were out.
HeroClix is like a... It's dice rolling, right? Dice rolling miniatures.
Well, it's a dice rolling game, but
you've got these little minis, and they come on a base that clicks around and it points at different things. And
exactly.
there's a tactical strategy thing to different. So different minis are different.
Thought
have different
involved.
Powers and things. Yeah,
concentration.
Well, a little bit
attention.
It's the attention part.
Yeah,
it is the attention part because there's this concept of taking turns, and we were. There were, I think, eight of us in a friend's garage, and we were all huge. It was a beautiful setup. It was a big, big setup, and we all had a couple, it's all superheroes-based, at least it was then. So, I had my guys. I had Kingpin and Hulk, and they were throwing down with this guy. He had, I think, four figures, and every time it came this person's turn to move his HeroClix, he was over in the corner engaging in some sort of personal conversation with them.
Oh, jeez.
Along the lines of...
He was playing with his dolls.
Yes!
Like, with who's them?
The miniatures. The plastic dolls.
Yeah.
The little toys.
He's got little toys, and he's over there. We're all like, all right, I use my overall power to scare those three guys away. I roll a d6. Oh, I take two clicks of damage. Oh, I'm upset. Okay, guy over there who's incredibly stoned, time to move your figs. Spidey doesn't want to fight, man. Spidey's feeling righteous and powerful. Spidey shows himself to his foes. Dude!
Roll the effing dice!
Dude, there is no Spidey shows himself to his foe click, okay? Yeah. So don't do it. So you're going to your point about people being stoned. Well, yes, yes.
And on top of all that, he ate all your food.
So you gave me that. It's this opportunity for people to socialize and get, okay, I do get that. I really do. And well, heck, one of the reasons that Shane Hensley always cites for having created the RPG Savage Worlds is exactly that impetus that you can maybe, if you're lucky, get together once a week to game with your regular adult group. Mm-hmm. And he always built that particular game around the concept of, hey, we're able to finish something. We did something cool in a single 3-hour session.
Which is why, the game is kind of rules. It's a robust game, but it's straightforward. It's pretty
good.
Fast and Furious, as it's called.
Yeah, and as I just got back in not long ago into a first edition game with my oldest gaming group, my oldest gaming friends who I've known since my very early teens, and we went back and we said, what the heck, let's do it. First edition, Keep on the Borderlands. There is a whole lot of walking in old school D&D. There's a whole lot of, how do we get there? Well, we roll on this adventure table every 7.5 feet.
Yeah, well, guess what? D&D was in a great part based on Lord of the Rings. And there was an awful lot of walking there, too.
So Craig, I know your list was much more robust, to borrow your term, than mine. How'd you do?
I got the big thing that we were going after. Me and two buddies down here are doing the D&D All Access Pass thing, which is the ridiculously and almost comically overpriced like super VIP thing, where it covers four events and a crap ton of swag that they're not telling you what it is, but it's the 40th anniversary of D&D.
So one is
gambling that they're pulling out all the stops.
Yes.
And, the fifth edition is coming out soon. There was a blurb in an email that came back to me after I got that said, you'll be getting a bunch of freebies, including, and this is a rough quote, a product that has not been announced yet. And the player's handbook for 5th edition has not been announced yet. And I'm guessing that's what's going to be. Everybody who goes in there is going to probably end up with a signed player's handbook, signed by like the R&D people or something like
that.
And they might, and the player's handbooks might not be fully on sale at Gen Con. They may not go sale, you know, on sale until September worldwide and all that kind of thing. Who knows? So there might be, you know, a group of a few hundred people coming out of Gen Con with the book a month before everybody else.
See, here I was thinking it was 5th edition Dragonlance or something.
Hmm?
Oh, I figured it was like 5th edition Dragonlance or something.
5th age? That's what that's called. Well, anyway, no, okay. We Mike's getting bored. Let's go to something here. Too much gaming talk.
No, it just happened this morning. You have to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're recording this like a week and a half in advance. So, this will be we're recording early for this one. But anyway,
I think one of the things that'll be interesting to look back on is how this all went. I mean, by the time this airs, we're going to be having the postmortems. They already had the postmortem on housing for Gen Con, and how for the first time they're putting pressure on Indianapolis to expand the housing options because of how quickly the housing block available. Sold in what, 58 minutes?
Something like that.
This year. And to see how this went, it is indicative of how huge this event now is. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm certainly going to look back and see what they're talking about. Because I'm applying right now. I'm getting ready to apply, actually, for two much smaller cons that talk a little bit about those things that I was going to share with you guys on this show, which are both Origins and Historicon.
Oh, history geek.
Well, out at Origins.
Well, let's get to it.
Yeah.
Let's jump on this.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, you ready?
Yeah.
To talk.
Sure. Okay. News. Since we just got done pointing out that this is, you know, a week and a half ago,
right? Nerdburger bringing you news way past.
Yeah. And since I forgot to mention this last week, you know, they found, or they think they found the Santa Maria.
Oh, I'm looking at the page right here. You stole my news.
Oh, you go ahead and do it then.
No, go.
I don't know. I was just pointing that out. I didn't actually read it.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's just, the topography that they've taken and there's just, you know, they've studied it a bit and they think they found the Santa Maria wrecked in the Caribbean. Right.
You did notice that the first thing they expressed their fears about was looting, right?
Mm-hmm.
the minute they announced it, they apparently had to try to lock it down. Because now, if you know anything about the Santa Maria and its history, the thing that struck me was, what do you think they're going to find on it? Those guys were in bad shape by the time that ship went down. A bunch of rats' bones that were chewed through. Some leather strapping they had boiled for soup. I mean, yeah, this isn't... This isn't Sir Francis Drake's, you know, cache of doubloons.
Yeah, these are the, you know, Columbus and his guys were the guys that showed up and, yeah, they got a few trinkets and things, but they weren't the guys that went charging into the mountains and stole, you know, just Brazilians
of
dollars worth of gold and treasure.
Yeah, looted whole civilizations.
Yeah, these guys are going to have like, oh, there's like, you know, some dude's headdress. That's all decayed and waterlogged and blah.
Nice rusty Morian. Well done.
Do you want to know what else just from history? Something else has happened here. Do you have, you know, $35 million kind of floating around? Maybe you want to travel over to Transylvania?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And by Dracula's castle?
Except he didn't live there.
I can't afford to travel to Dracula, let alone.
Can't afford the R.
Yeah, Bran Castle, long one of Romania's top tourist attractions, has been owned by all sorts of people. Supposedly, Vlad the Impaler, whose sadistic rule was the source of many vampire legends, operated in the area in 15th century and is believed to have have been imprisoned at the castle at one point.
Oh, so it's not even his castle.
Yeah, apparently.
It's his jail.
I love, you know, they have to go ahead and do some of the wordplay. The agent handling the sale says the owner could make a killing by refurbishing the castle and turning it into the kind of place people will stay for 2 or 3 days, which I would like to point out is the amount of time Jonathan Harker planned to spend at the castle in Dracula.
Yeah.
He ended up there much longer because he got taken prisoner and was being fed on by Dracula's brides. By the three crazy vampire
ladies. Was
that
Keanu Reeves?
In the movie, yes. In the book, it was Jonathan Harker, and he didn't say, whoa.
Well, you know, I don't read, so.
I have a friend who was sitting across from me at brunch one day, and I looked up, and I said, so, I know it was a big deal to you. Bram Stoker's Dracula, what do you think? And he looked up from his waffles and said, Francis Ford Coppola smokes a turd in hell.
Wow. Hey. Somebody didn't like that movie.
No.
Yeah, that was a no.
Did anyone like that movie?
I like parts of it.
Yeah.
I think Gary Oldman is awesome.
Well, yeah.
In that movie. I think his portrayal of Dracula is unlike any other.
Gary Oldman is awesome in that HTC commercial he's doing right now. So I mean,
I was thinking about that. Yeah. I'm like, what have I seen him in?
But the guy who plays recently? the guy who plays oh, crap. What's his name? Renfield.
That's Tom Waits.
Tom Waits. He's great in that movie. Renfield is spectacular. He's the guy who's eating bugs.
Yeah.
Who's like Dracula's like little minion. He's been swayed by the Prince of Undeath.
I went and saw it.
He ends up going insane. He ends up in an asylum and Dr. Seward is studying him. And they're, you know, that's all.
I don't even remember that. I saw it in the theater when it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And not since. Oh, I didn't know Tom Waits was in that. I might need to check it out again.
There you go.
With some beers.
And the girl who plays Lucy is smoking hot.
Who's Lucy?
Lucy is Mina's friend who gets bitten by Dracula first, the redhead.
Oh, okay.
Who gets naked. And ends up humping Dracula in like partial wolf form in the garden.
Yeah. Who's that actress?
I don't remember.
You just remember she's hot.
She's beautiful. But yeah, Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder leave much to be desired, unfortunately. And Anthony Hopkins chews the scenery a little much.
You don't say.
Only in that movie, though.
Yeah, right. I was gonna say. Because he's such an understated actor.
Otherwise. Yeah, he plays such subtle characters.
By the time he gets to the 12th Hannibal the Cannibal movie, I'm sure he's going to be doing it in drag.
Well, you know.
But look, I admire Sir Anthony immensely. I mean, look, he's one of the last generation of true great British working actors. These guys that just show up and make money, you know, and yet they do commit themselves to it. But they're going to rise to the level of the text. They will do Hannibal. But don't expect masterworks out of them. On the other hand, when he does some, you know, he's in Lion and Winter, for God's sakes, and he's wonderful.
Sure. Mike?
Yes.
Anything?
I don't really have any news, per se.
Have you guys done the Atari thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, you did the UT thing? Okay, good.
Yeah, they found him.
Yeah.
I just wonder about this. This is what our civilization has come to. We're not merely burying video games in the desert, which I always thought was weird, but we take it upon ourselves to spend money to go find them.
Mm-hmm. And more importantly, make documentaries and show everybody that we found them.
Okay, I would have
believed you. Because we're not already inundated with too much media.
Right. This is it. It's just like Upworthy had nothing else to show us. Or, you know, the YouTube channel was empty. Can you imagine? YouTube is empty today. What are we going to do?
Well, then you'd go over to CNET.com and discover that an ancient D20 was discovered in Egypt.
Saw this. they found a shape. It's a shape. That
no,
must...
it's a 20-sided die. It's got 20 faces on it. It looks like the D20 that we all know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a symbol on every face, and it's Greek letters.
Greek letters for what? Are they in sequence?
They say that like the ones that can be made out clearly... Eta, theta, and epsilon can be clearly seen. You know, they make their jokes too.
The Egyptian kids no one else would play with.
Yeah. The let's go back in time, way back. Keep going. Okay, stop. You're in the Ptolemaic period. It's somewhere around 304 to 30 BC. You're in Egypt. Okay. You're playing Dungeons and Dragons. Except back then, it's like pyramids and Patsukos.
Oh, wouldn't it nice. Be, nice.
Wouldn't it Patsukos being a giant alligator.
Delta and
monster.
Delta.
D and D. Well, if they shortened it, sure. Yeah. But I thought that was good. They took it from dungeons to pyramids, which is a structure with treasure within it.
Mm-hmm.
And from dragons to Patsukos. Is that how that's pronounced? Patsukos, Patsuchos, which are alligators.
Mm-hmm.
They're big, big lizards. So they found it. It's made out of rock. It's in relatively good shape.
Did they say what they think it's actually for? I assumed when I just saw the article briefly that it was a tool of divination or something like that.
Probably. They'd make too many jokes about it. It's like, but I'd like to think it was used to roll for hit points for warrior and sphinx classes.
Those are D8s.
Or maybe it was used to determine which frat the ancients were going to pledge.
Oh, man. No love over there.
Yeah. Not in this article. They don't really. There's some people in the comments, if we want to go to the comments.
Oh, remember, at any point, you're three steps from racism. Be careful.
probably for divination by grammatomancy.
Oh, sure. Sure. That makes sense. Just, the significance of letters.
So, there you go. We'll go with that.
Okay. So, two episodes ago,
right?
One of the alternate episode titles was Douchebaguette.
for the female douchebag, yes.
Right. And so, when I was looking that up to see how to correctly spell it,
right?
Because, it's on the internet.
Sure.
I found it on Urban Dictionary. And I found the entire list of everything that all the words that are related to douchebag.
The entire douchebag family.
Yes. So I will be reading from that from time to time.
Oh, you're pulling my bit. Yes. We're gonna punctuate
yes,
the episode with those. Okay.
Not only will I be reading from that list, but I will be reading from another list that I found while searching for that list, which is the list of doing the somethings. Like how we say doing the science.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, there are many, many pages of doing the whatever.
Okay.
One of which I'll get out of the way right now, is doing the Craig.
What's that?
Funny you should ask. Do you really want me to read the definition of
doing
the Craig?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Okay, I do too. That's 2-1. Craig's outvoted. Doing the Craig. To engage in homosexual activities with a with a U.S. congressman in a bathroom, preferably at an airport.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. That guy, the wide stance. Yeah.
And you know where that
signaling
came,
under the partition.
You know where that came from, right? This is from Urban Dictionary.
Yeah.
It's one person on the internet trying to be funny.
That yeah.
That's where it came from.
Nick Kruger, December 3rd, 2007, and it's the only entry.
Yeah, because he made that joke to his two buddies while they were playing Halo, and they laughed. So then he put it on Urban Dictionary. Yep. Look at me. What's his name?
I closed it already.
What was it?
Nick Kruger.
Fuck you, Nick.
Ooh, hey.
Because I've had this running thing where I watch, with TV shows and movies and books and stuff, I have a hard time finding Craigs that are, the hero.
Fuck you, Nick, you douchepotamus.
There you go. I've had a hard time finding Craigs that are the hero. They always just end up being anywhere between just the villain or negative, a-hole characters or whatever, all the way to neutral, nothing kind of, boring characters. I don't remember the last, if I've ever found her or the last time I came across, here's the star of the story and he's a good guy and he's named Craig. Just doesn't happen. Now, of course, I don't have any examples, but anyway.
Do you want to talk about language?
We could.
I found these maps this week, last week, 2 weeks ago.
Whenever. You can just say, I found some maps.
There you go. I found these maps. And it's, would you like to take a guess as to the Most commonly spoken language other than English in any, pretty much any state.
I might be able to guess these just from having seen the map, but go ahead.
Well,
because I've seen this.
Well, this one, just you don't even need to see the map. It's going to be Spanish in most of them, except for Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. French.
Huh. New Hampshire and Vermont. Really?
Because Mexicans don't want to live in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont.
I guess.
They don't let Mexicans live in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. You ever been up there?
Louisiana, obviously, is also French. North Dakota, German.
Sure.
Wisconsin's German.
No, this is the second.
Gotcha. After English. On the next layer after Spanish.
The third most spoken language is the funny one. That's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, there's some really weird ones.
There's a lot of German.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin is German. Illinois. Polish.
Okay.
The only one. You've got Italian in Jersey and Pennsylvania. Go, shocker. Yeah.
Forget about it.
And then, now they've got French listed again.
Move on. Don't question it.
In Maine, Hampshire, oops.
But maybe those are the only two languages spoken, yeah. And they had to default to French.
Portuguese in Massachusetts and Rhode Island.
Yeah, I've seen some of that. Like, you get these. There's Portuguese and there's some Eastern Asian languages in some states that you would never expect them to be in.
Yeah,
like anything that's not West Coast.
Right. No, yeah. Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, Vietnamese.
Third most spoken language.
Yeah. And California and Nevada, Tagalog.
Oh.
Tagalog.
Well, that's how I thought it was pronounced until I was corrected by someone who is married to a Filipino.
I was going to say, till you met a Filipino.
Yeah. Most commonly spoken Native American language in Wisconsin.
Menominee?
Nope. Ojibwa.
Ojibwa, sure.
Also sure. Michigan and Minnesota. Here in Georgia, it's Cherokee.
Cherokee.
And as it is throughout most of the Southeast and Southern states, Navajo out the Southwest.
Hmm.
Northwest is Sahoptian. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Most commonly spoken Scandinavian language in Wisconsin. Any guesses?
No idea.
Say Norwegian.
You would be correct.
All right. I went to Old World Wisconsin when I was 12.
In Georgia, it is Swedish. here we go. Most commonly spoken African language.
Ooh.
Here, I'm gonna.
I'm not even gonna take a stab at that because I'm gonna end up coming out.
Okay.
Sound like an idiot.
Here in Vermont, Kansas, and Wyoming, this African language is the most commonly spoken African language.
I'm going to guess Zulu or Africa. Well, yeah, Zulu. It's its own form of speech.
It is Swahili.
Swahili.
That was actually going to be my guess. I would have actually gotten it right. I was like, but I was afraid that one of you guys was going to say, well, that's the only one you've ever heard of.
Oh, also Hawaii. Sorry, I missed Hawaii hanging out down there at the bottom of the map. So there you go. And then coincidentally, I also found this. Somebody put together maps which show which languages besides English, Spanish are most prevalent around Wisconsin. And it's by county.
Wow.
Okay, well, I don't...
And they don't label the counties. So, I know where Milwaukee County is.
This is fun with the census, is what this is.
It's Hmong in Milwaukee.
Yes, yes. We actually have a very... We had a sizable population of Montagnards come in after the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. And then some various, German and other Native American languages. But I just thought that was odd that came out, the next day. After this nationwide series of maps.
Would you like to hear some more language fun?
Sure.
Real quick.
Mm-hmm.
The language of, and I'm going to try to pronounce this, Ayapeneco sounds Native American.
Sure.
Has been spoken in the land now known as Mexico for centuries. It has survived the Spanish conquest, seen off wars, revolutions, famines, and floods. But now, like so many other indigenous languages, it's at risk of extinction. There are just two people left who can speak it fluently, but they refuse to talk to each other.
Oh, no.
Manuel Segovia and Isidro Velasquez, who are in their late 60s and mid-70s, live 500 meters apart in the village of Ayapa in the tropical lowland of the southern state of Tabasco. It is not clear whether there's a long-buried argument behind their mutual avoidance, but people who know them say they have never really enjoyed each other's company.
Wow.
Since they were five.
So say goodbye to that language.
It's already effectively dead.
If they're that old, they're not turning around on that.
But here's the thing. Bear in mind, I mean, and this always gives me the wig, we're sitting here in 2014. So these guys at the outside were born in what, 1940?
Right.
So these guys are almost baby boomers. This isn't some ancient, deep-rooted Native American curse grudge. These guys came up in the atomic age, pissed at each other. Like, who didn't tell these guys we don't do this anymore? It's like, oh my God, oh my, wow. Well, I remember once Michael Wood and his In Search of the Trojan War went all the way to Turkey to try to find a bard. And it turned out there were like eight of them left, and most of them were blind from drinking this rot gut whiskey they drink over there. And they just sit in the bar and for hours on end tell stories for money. And they refuse, because they don't trust the government, to go in and be recorded for posterity's sake.
So all those tales were lost.
Yeah, culture and language. And we live in this internet age where we put so much junk out there. But the notion that we're necessarily then going to preserve all these things just isn't so.
Well, we're going to preserve all these things, but 98% of these things are crap.
Right, right.
We've lost really important stuff.
Right. This precious language that survived the European context and Turkish and Turkish bardic tales are lost, but our porn is safe.
That's right.
Well, more importantly, this language, Ayapaneco, is going to die out, but Urban Dictionary is going to live forever.
Yep.
And we'll still be talking about, you know, doing the Craig, right?
Yeah.
Doucheroo.
Veto right now. Veto right now. That's not the episode title.
Okay. Doucheria.
No.
Douchesaurus.
No.
Doucheosaurus Rex.
Doing the Craig is not
the episode title. Oh, doing the Craig is not the episode title. Okay.
Let's be clear on that. You can put it in the alternates.
Yeah. Douchatron.
Nice.
I loved it when he combined with all the other douches to make a really big one.
More than meets the eye.
Except the sound has to be a little more squishy and less metallic. Really, really didn't need the demo, but that's wow.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you can put your pants back on now.
No, that wasn't.
Wee.
Okay, douchebaganarian, douchebaganism. Douchebaggins.
Douchebaggins.
of the Sackville douchebaggins.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Jim?
Yes?
War simulators.
War simulators.
Go. We have wound you up. We've put the little key in your back. Tightened it right up to the point that the spring's about to just deform. Go.
I want to go all the way back to what we started talking about, which was the fact that you said, Craig, that gaming in some ways, especially RPG gaming, came from Wisconsin. And it did. It's amazing to me as I go back, and I can't quite trace it back far enough, but when you talk about Lake Geneva, when you talk about the Chicago and the tri-state area, we were a hub in the late 60s and early 70s of a lot of this evolution of gaming. And it came out of war gaming. It didn't actually come from RPGs originally. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were playing war games long before they were playing what became Dungeons & Dragons. And Chainmail is originally this simulation of medieval warfare intended to be played with 25-millimeter lead figures. And as I've gone back and started to collect some of these old books, I remembered back to my childhood when, before I got D&D, I picked up a copy of a game at Gimbel's. We used to have this chain of stores around here called Gimbel's. And it was in Cudahy, Wisconsin, and I was walking around, and there was nothing I wanted to see. By the way, can I ask a question in passing and maybe give me some help? I was in Boston store with my wife the other day, and I was trying to figure out who purchases women's lingerie in Boston store anymore. Nobody does that, I don't think, if certainly not if you're under 30.
I was wondering who shopped at all in Boston store until you mentioned your, well, you and your wife were in there.
Well, she was in there trying to buy shoes for me, and I wasn't, I'm no use on that. So, but we walked around anyway, and I was in Boston store, it'd be 1978, 1979, and up on the wall there was a copy of the Avalon Hill game Starship Troopers, based on the original Heinlein novels, you know, before t-shirts could stop nuclear blasts. And you know that's the dumbest. That's the dumbest.
That's a Starship Trooper movie joke.
Yeah, that was the dumbest science fiction movie ever made, without any exception.
Yes, but I love it. Oh, it has Herr Hauser in it.
It does.
Doogie Howser the Nazi.
Yeah, when did Doogie Howser become Heinrich Himmler? When did that happen?
Right.
It is afraid.
In that movie. You saw it. That's where he became. Anyway.
I love Starship Troopers so much, and I had been reading it for years, and so I was excited to have this, and I took it home, and it made my head explode, because it was ridiculously complicated. But clearly this could not have been my fault. I'm far too intelligent for that, so I must conquer this thing. I've still got the game. But war simulation, the use of board games, the use of electronic games, has actually come a great distance, and it's evolved. It's evolved along two paths. One of them is aesthetic, which is the board war, the miniatures games, where the guys get out and paint tons and tons of figures and all this other stuff. But the other is the more simulation-driven, which are computer games and board games. And for 1 week in June and 1 week in July, I'm going to be in Columbus, Ohio, if you believe that.
Good luck.
Voluntarily. In fact, I'm paying – well, they're paying for me to go, but I'm going to be part of – what they call the War College out there. And it's a group of guys who are actually the staff to the War College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And we're going to get together and we're going to do war simulations inside of Origins. And it's going to be a long series of video games and board games where they try to instruct anybody who wants to buy a ticket. That's always the fun part. Any in the way that they teach, because these are the guys that actually teach it to real live life and death soldiers.
Wow.
That they're going to instruct them in the same way they teach these guys, the exact same principles. And I'm going to be part of that crew. And I'm really kind of excited because there's actually some videos online of me running a couple of games out there some years ago. And I'm going back out there and we're going to see this stuff. But the lessons that you learn dealing with people, first of all, it makes you incredibly grateful for the soldiers that we have. That there are certain people who are willing to learn these very, very difficult things and to learn team building. I am convinced, and this is kind of where I tie this all the way back into the question I asked you earlier, Craig, and it's why I made a note to it. Mm-hmm. When you play a game at a con, in your experience, what percentage of the time does everybody want to be the caller?
The caller?
Yeah, the guy who speaks for the group.
Oh, I don't know. I've never really given any thought to that.
Okay. Is it typically a cooperative experience in your experience?
My experience, it typically has been.
Okay. That's fact. Okay. Wow. I'm impressed by that. And because that, based on my experience with the wargaming side of the community, it's 180 degrees the other way.
Okay. Well, right. But most of my experience, 90% of my experience is with RPGs, and most RPGs are collaborative. You know, the players are playing a team who's attempting to accomplish something. And there might be somebody who takes up more of a leadership position and kind of leads the discussion of, like, if you've got to develop a plan or figure out what you're going to do next or whatever, there's somebody that kind of gets in charge of that. But, you know, it's more collaborative. It has rarely resulted in, like, arguments or fights over who's in charge. I've seen it happen once or twice.
You've had Alan on, haven't you?
No. Alan is practically a Luddite. I talked to him about it, and he says the only time he ever checks online is with his phone. He doesn't do anything on a computer.
Okay.
So it would be hard to Skype him.
Okay, because he always tells the story of the time that he was playing. I think it was a neutral evil elf who went while his party was asleep to make a deal with the dragon they were intending to confront the next day.
Mm-hmm.
To explain to the dragon who it was he wanted to live and who he wanted to die and what he was willing to exchange for that. And the dragon, because it was the alignment of the dragon, agreed to the deal and wound up with a party wipe. These were his friends.
Yeah, but
and I've what so not so much in the convention experience.
When well, here's a question: how long ago was that?
Oh, my guess would be 6 to 8 years ago.
Okay, so not terribly long ago. Yeah. Were everybody in the group? You guys were all friends.
Yeah, before, yeah.
Well, well, okay. Were you not friends afterwards?
No, it was fine.
Okay,
it was,
well,
there was a whole lot of, you're a dick.
But yeah, and that's the point. What it was a bunch of people that had an agreed upon or implied social contract that that type of thing is going to happen. And if somebody wants to do that, and if it makes for an entertaining story, everybody's going to be okay with it. And so you guys dealt with it. And I've played in games in conventions and outside of conventions where things like that have happened. But I've never had it, you know, I've never played in a particularly backstabby party where it's always just people are just totally out for themselves to try to, quote, win the game.
Okay, because that's the part I never got. Is the concept of either in the military simulation, which is a weird thing to say, but also in RPGs, the concept of winning as the primary focus. When you train in a war simulation, the goal isn't winning, it's instruction. Did you get the lessons you're supposed to learn? And if you won at the expense of every common sense bit of, you know, the things you're being instructed, you still will receive a failing grade. Mike, I'm curious, do you game or do you just sit around and work the sound dials?
He games some.
I game. Some, yeah.
So you look at, so you kind of just look at this from a distance?
Pretty much.
Okay. Okay. Because I'm trying to learn this, you know, cross-culturally. And I'll tell you the three stories that inform me, and they're all very quick. The first was I was at Historicon, the place I'm going in July, which is in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is a great part of the world. And I was there, and it's a whole bunch of guys. We're all about my age. I'm actually the young guy in my mid to late 40s. And there's a whole bunch of guys that are in their 60s. And you have never met. You want to pull a douchebag word out for me there, Mike?
Douchebags in the mist.
Oh, nice. Nice. Some of these guys are some of my best friends, and I love their company, and I would go to the gates of hell for them. Some of them are a slavering horde of douchebags in the mist.
Yeah.
I was playing this gigantic Austerlitz game, you know, Napoleon, December of 1805, something like 7,500 little lead figures on a table, 25 feet long by 8 feet wide. So you've got the ape arms as you're trying to get to the middle. And I'm way down at the southern end of the battlefield, and I'm fighting out with a guy who became a good friend of mine from Manitoba, Canada. And we're enemies, you know, but he's teaching me the game. He's showing me how the process works. He wants to win, but that's not the biggest thing in the whole world to him. But I'm aware that seriously, 5 feet away from me on the other side of the board, there's a dude on the French team who is just turning into a screaming douchebag in the mist. And I can't figure out what's going on. And he is getting louder, and he is pounding the table, and he's pointing.
Because he wants to win. And he's losing.
I guess, but there was no sense of proportionality. His own team was looking at him going, dude, relax, relax, you know, calm down. And I wondered about this, and I wonder what happens sociologically when this transfers. And I'm walking along through the convention hall. It's a huge, huge convention spread out all over the place. And I'm walking along, and I see a bunch of kids being refereed in a Starship Troopers bug squashing game, okay? And the referee is dumping big buckets of giant rubber spiders onto the table and saying, oh, bugs, Mr. Rico, zillions of them! You know, and it's fun, and the kids are moving their figures around. And all of a sudden, I see this 9-year-old kid, he couldn't have been 10, with a ruler in his hand, looking up at the referee going, my flamer has a 7-inch range, not a 6-inch range, 7 inches. And I'm going, did you notice the rubber spiders being dumped on the table? Those were rubber spiders.
Yeah.
And he's being silly. And it brings out all this stuff in us. And the fact that our military is capable of taking our best impulses to win and to achieve and to conquer and yet still have people be part of a team.
Yeah.
Is one of the remarkable things that it does and how it instructs. Because, and the third story just goes to, nobody wants to be part of a team. And I was interested to hear you say that RPGers maybe have that. But
We get a lot of military guys playing RPGs, don't we?
Oh, yeah. It's very popular.
You know, we get a lot of ex-military.
It's very popular. It's very portable. They just have to have a set of dice and a book, and a bunch of people can play a game.
Yeah.
Well, and so here's my thought on that from the RPG point of view, because, like I said, sure, all of my really the bulk of my experience is in RPGs. And when I say that, you know, for the conflict simulation thing, it's all about instruction.
Yeah.
For RPGs, it's not it's not so much about winning, although there's certainly you want to attain the goal, or, you know, slay the dragon, save the princess, whatever it is. But I personally consider the game a win if we share an entertaining story. If I have something that I can come away with and we can, like you said, reminisce about and talk about with that group down the road, that it was a fun time and we told a fun and entertaining and engaging story, then I consider that a win. I'm not concerned about whether or not one or all of the characters died, whether or not they defeated all the bad guys, or maybe one of them got away or whatever. And you know, in the games that I play in, I've been blessed. I've sought out the groups of players and friends who like to play the game where they just kind of stay cooperative and they don't backstab each other. I'm sure you can go out there and find groups of people that's their play style and that's just how they do it, where they're always kind of, well, we're kind of on a team, but we're also kind of out for ourselves, and we're going to, occasionally one person's going to piss somebody else off. It always blows me away when I go onto gaming forums online and stuff and see all these people looking for advice about how do I deal with this player who's you know, playing his character in such a way that he's out to backstab the other characters and da da da, and these people, you know, these people are sort of friends and I'd like them to be better friends and I don't want to kick this guy out, but people are getting ticked off, and I'm like, I'm blessed. I've never run into that.
You see that there's a seminar on that topic at Gen Con.
Oh, yeah.
Dealing with the contrarian player. And I thought, well, first of all, that's a seminar. But yeah. Secondly, that's a problem.
Yeah, well, obviously it is.
Yeah.
Because right, I see it brought up on message boards all the time. It wouldn't get a seminar. I'm sure that seminar has probably been, or something like it, has been done every year for many years. Because because it gets an audience, because there are problems.
So yeah, we've, you know, and
now here's a quick question, a quick note on the funny side of things. If I'm hanging around with my players, like let's say I get together for our D&D game next Saturday night, and me and Ray and Andy, who are all going to Gen Con together, and I say, oh, and by the way, I signed up for the dealing with contrarian players seminar. How are they supposed to react?
Well, you don't mean me, right?
Oh, no. And then the next guy at the table.
I'd really like both of you to join me.
I bought you tickets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Episode title.
I bought you tickets.
I've been lucky. I've in part been lucky, and in part I've sought that out and managed to find it. So,
what's your number one game these days?
Overall, between what I run and what I play, I'd say it's still D&D.
Okay.
But we've played some Pathfinder, we played some Gamma World, which are really just extensions of D&D. I ran some Savage Worlds, I ran some Deadlands a while back. I've got my game that I'm designing and playing. Well, I'm running. I haven't actually had a chance to play a character yet. One of these days I will. I got to get it into a form that it's in good enough shape for somebody to sit down and take what I've written and design their own adventure.
Yes.
So that I can then play. So one of these days, later this year sometime, I'll get Dave or Ando or somebody to do that when they have time.
There's no douche gamer, but there is douche gasm.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. Deus ex machina.
Deus ex machina. Douche of the gods.
Yeah. No,
machine of the douche.
That's from the machine.
Yeah. Douche
from the machine.
Yeah, that's
so that's at the end of the story, somebody comes in and just craps all over you and ends the story.
Just
tears you apart, rips you up, just kind of destroys everything and then walks away, drops the mic.
Douche bread, douche carrot, douche casserole.
They're trying too hard now.
And since we're talking food, and to wrap up the douches, of course, douche burger.
Nice.
Alternate title for our website.
Yeah.
Change the podcast. Maybe in year three, we'll change the podcast. and we'll just
once we get over 100,
yeah, we'll just
reset the counter.
We'll just be a-holes and just rip on everything. We'll just tear into our guests and see how quickly we can get people to not want to be on the show.
Oh man.
No, we won't do that.
We'll do that if that doucheburger guy wins his lawsuit against Adam Carolla and shuts down everyone's podcast.
Oh yeah, I did see that. So the question I would ask you guys about war simulations.
All right,
give it a shot. This is going to be a simple one.
Okay,
in June of 1940. Adolf Hitler ends what they call the Zitzkrieg, the phony war, mm-hmm. and invades over into France. And
taking the scenic route through Belgium.
Exactly. Look at you.
I know my like eighth grade history.
Get over here and play. We'll be good. And I wonder, the original Avalon Hill game on this called France 1940 specifically said in the designer's notes, the way we set up this game is ahistorical. If you want to try this historically, here's your setup. But we don't know why anybody would want to do that.
Because we've already seen that play out.
Mm-hmm. Right. We saw how it plays out. But one of the big things that war simulation is about, as opposed to a war game necessarily, is trying to put you in the shoes of a commander and face the challenges that the commander at the time faced, which requires a certain amount of recalibration, or in fact, a dismissal of the question of whether you win or lost. It's just how did the experience run and what did you learn from it? So if I said to you guys, hey, I've got this game. It's France 1940. I need you to play the French. And you're going to get creamed. But how you get creamed is going to be more important than that you get creamed.
Okay.
Is that something on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being let's pound nails into our dicks, and number 10 and number 10 is I would like this better than time spent alone with the red-haired girl from Bram Stoker's Dracula?
All right.
Where is that?
Where's what? Hello?
What's the likelihood you do that?
Oh, well, to go in basically knowing that you're going to play the loser, it's just a question of how you go out.
Yes.
Well, setting aside just, you know, French surrender jokes, you know, and if I'm putting myself in the position of a historical, you know, someone in 1940, and the things that they have to deal with, you know, I'll just set aside the irritation over no high-speed internet in 1940. I would be interested in maybe doing that one time at, like, the level of 7 or 8.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I can see the value in role-playing, you know, just in RPGs, too, of playing the, like, you're gonna go down swinging. It's not about winning the fight. It's about fighting the fight.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you don't give up, and maybe, you know, in the process, you martyr yourself, or your men, you know, become heroes, or, you know, it's the Alamo.
Yes.
Yeah. I'd get involved in that. Sure. I don't know if I'd be like, wow, awesome, mm-hmm. but I'd get into it. Sure. Mike, you want to play the loser? How long is this game? That'll probably govern Mike's response.
our usual sessions are 4 hours.
Okay. One time, 4 hours. Mm-hmm. You're going to play the loser.
You know you're going to lose.
Would I?
Would you play that level? Rating 1 to 10. 10 being, oh, yeah, sign me up. Would you want to play that game? One
do
time.
Do I have to start at 1? can I use 0?
Okay. That's
no. Why would you not try to win?
Well, you could try, but you're not. We're not giving you the pieces right. sufficient that you can.
Why would you play if winning was not a possibility?
It's trying to. Well, the point that they're trying to impart is then the French. Go ahead.
Then you might as well just dress up in costume and go reenact somewhere.
No, that's and that is, by the way, that's the
the
that's
outcome the, is predetermined.
That's one of the big arguments, and that's really one of the primary reason I asked the question, is that's the argument people have about how far you get to move the goalposts and sure. where you get to move them, because the French lose in part because they adopt a really, really bad strategy. And so the question is, do you have to choose that strategy, or can you pick a different one? Technologically, they're actually ahead of the Germans in June of 40. But they choose a particularly bad strategy. So where that gets moved to, so you're saying you might get more interested the more of a fighting chance you have, but if it's basically a dead man's torpedo to nowhere, you're out.
Yeah, I mean...
And there I'd you have it, the difference between Mike and Craig.
Yeah, you're no, I mean, I'd have to be already really into it to bother with it. I mean, I can see why people would do it. Why okay. they would play, knowing that they're just going to lose. But
sure.
The most popular World War II miniatures rules right now is a set called Flames of War. You'll see it all over the place. It'll be all over Gen Con. There's a good dozen, two dozen games being run of it. And they just came out with their France 1940 book. And my exact comment when I saw it was, well, there's the book nobody buys.
Now, right. Keep in mind, though, my response was, I would do that one time.
Yeah. No. And that's
for the experience of it. Be like, yeah. Hey, yeah. We look how much longer than we lasted in this simulation than the French actually did. Mm-hmm. You might be able to get away with that.
Yeah, somewhere up here in October, I'm not sure I got to get a big enough hall. I'm going to be running on the anniversary a refight of the Battle of Trafalgar from 1805, the naval battle. And you're talking about 75 to 100 little fighting ship thingies. And it's a technical term. And the French have exactly no chance. I mean, it's just going to be a question of the magnitude of the British victory. But I'm surprised how many people are signing up to play the French just to try to do a little bit better than history. And some of them particularly want to take out particular ships that diddle, you know, and they tell the little stories within. So I'm intrigued by that because it's one of the hardest lessons that the War College tries to impart.
Well, you're probably looking at some of those people. I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of the people that play these games are giant history geeks.
Yeah. Yes.
So they're going to come away from it with the story that they can share with their other giant history geek friends saying, hey, I played the French in Trafalgar and we actually survived a little while. look how long we hung in there. And they'll be able to talk to that in terms of history and of how the simulation went and get some, you know, get a story out of that and get a little bragging right.
That certainly makes sense.
Now me, I don't know the specifics of the Battle of Trafalgar. I get the World War II with the French thing. I understand that a little more.
All I know is there was a Picard that fought there.
There was. That's true.
Do they teach the Picard maneuver in these simulations? Is your Panzer tank going to jump by light speed at warp maximum warp and appear to be in two places at once?
Are we gonna have the whole question of warp drive on Star Trek and why it doesn't work the way they say it does? Have you ever seen this paper that somebody wrote? I think he was from MIT. It's a 30 page paper on why warp doesn't work that way.
Okay, here's my 30 character description of why warp doesn't work that way. It's an effing TV show. Did I come in under 30 characters?
Do I count the apostrophe?
You can count the spaces.
I think you did. I think you're okay.
There you go. Too long didn't read. It's an effing TV show. Yeah.
That's a Roger.
You giant Star Trek-ophile dorks out there. You started to describe that, and briefly I had that moment where Mike is done with like, well, of course that exists. Why was I even surprised for a millisecond?
It's a good paper.
You read the whole thing.
I have.
He did a 30-page counterpoint critique.
No. This dude's a real physicist. Okay. I wasn't even touching him.
Have you got a chance to read the game materials that I sent you?
I have.
Okay.
I'm gonna scan back just some. I've got some text. Do you want text comments? Like, you know, markup?
Editing?
Yeah.
Like, this is misspelled or this needs to be structured better? Or
yeah, that kind of thing.
If you really want to, that's fine. I'm more interested in the gameplay.
If you that's
want,
my impulse.
If you want to piss him off, yeah, go ahead.
You can do it, but here's the thing to keep in mind.
That was my takeaway from his response.
Whenever I do that to his emails, I get the electronic cold shoulder the rest of the day.
Yeah, until you screw up grammar or spelling, and then I nail you on it, and then we're even.
No, that's fine. And if you don't, that's cool. I'll just, no, I don't, I've got I, some... I've already got some notes on the gameplay, and I'll just send those along.
I don't think that's going to be, because I don't know that what I've written right now is, it's probably kind of close to how I'm going to write the final, but who knows? You know, it might change completely. I might approach it a little differently and rewrite it basically from the ground up. So nitpicky, nitpicky grammar stuff isn't going to help me. Just general structure of like, you know, did it flow? Like, you know, when you read this section and this section and this section, and as you went along through the thing, were you able to piece it all together? Because that's one of the things you run into with rule books, is you got to present the rules in the right order.
Yes.
You can't start talking about something that you're not going to actually explain until 20 pages later.
I'll just repeat that I've done a lot of time with these war simulation things where, yeah, it's actually even a bigger deal there. Because
the more technical the system is, the bigger, the harder is to deal with.
You're suddenly describing the operations of a weapon system you haven't introduced.
Right.
It's like, here's how we do mortar fire. We have mortars? Sweet.
And I took the tack of, I'll allow myself to say more on that later or described below.
Yeah.
Like 3 or 4 times.
Okay.
If I need to.
Okay.
But I tried not to do that too much. So
cool.
Well, you didn't come out saying, "Boy, that sucks." So that I'll
no,
I'll
no, no.
I'll take that as a win.
It doesn't. It does not suck.
How's
that?
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad people are actually getting a chance to go through it, though, because I finally got to put it in somebody's hands besides me and the players that I had a brief time at the table with. So,
sure.
Well, Jim.
Yeah, you need to go, huh?
Alas.
Alas and alack.
Our time is over.
Our time is up. I'm going to go greet the International Institute of Municipal Clerks, which is in town here this week.
How exciting.
What? You take that back. You take that sarcasm back. We're an awesome group. Look out, boy. Between us and the accountants. Woo, doggy.
Do we want to introduce some fairness here to the reading of the things off the internet?
Okay.
Doing the Michael.
Okay.
I didn't notice this one before.
Oh, good.
Staying in your hotel room all evening, whilst on a sex tourist holiday to Thailand, and furiously masturbating, then sleeping in your clothes.
The Michael Hutchins, I assume?
I have no idea what this is about, but...
That ended in asphyxiation.
Mm-hmm. Which is the name of an episode a long time ago. Doing the Moose, doing the Most, doing the Nasty, doing the Natalie Portman.
Whoa!
doing the Paris Hilton, doing the Sarah Palin, doing the three-hole punch.
I'd just like to point out that a lot of people have been doing the Paris Hilton.
Yes, yes. They have.
And
less so since she was really popular in the public eye. She's not so much anymore.
And doing the two-finger tango.
On that note.
Yeah, I think, are we going to go?
I think we're done.
All right. Mike, where can they find us?
NerdBurgerShow.com, at NerdBurgerShow on the Twitters and the Facebook, and email us, NerdBurgerShow@gmail.com. Oh, thanks, Jim.
Thank you, guys.
On the next episode of Nerd Burger, Mike and Craig stop speaking to each other, causing all their personal colloquialisms, shared slang, and in-jokes to die out. But Urban Dictionary is going to live forever. We should probably put that stuff on Urban Dictionary real quick.
That's just awesome.
Sweet! Spelled S-U-I-T-E.
That's right.